The question we're trying to answer this season on Solving JFK is, assuming that Lee Harvey Oswald did not act alone, if at all, in killing President Kennedy, then who did kill the president? We've covered the Secret Service, and up next is the FBI. What was the role of the FBI, if any, in President Kennedy's death? When we talk about the FBI, the starting point has to be J. Edgar Hoover. The main thing that I want to know about Hoover is whether he had any foreknowledge of the assassination and whether he knowingly participated in covering it up. To be able to unlock the answers to those bigger questions, first, we have to learn more about who Hoover was as a person and who he surrounded himself with. What did J. Edgar Hoover care about? What were his relationships like with key figures such as Robert Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and President Kennedy? And what other important connections did J. Edgar Hoover have?
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. John Edgar Hoover began his tenure as the head of the Bureau of Investigation in 1924 when he was appointed by President Calvin Coolidge. Hoover went on to serve 48 years as the head of the BOI and later the FBI. During that time, working under eight different presidents, Hoover gained an immense amount of power and influence. Hoover set up the FBI to run exactly how he wanted it, with himself right at the center of everything. He thought very highly of himself and of the Bureau as an institution. Hoover even called the FBI the seat of government, which, by the way, is defined as the building, complex of buildings, or the city from which a government exercises its power. Hoover wasn't talking about Washington, D.C. when he said seat of government. He was talking about the FBI. Hoover had absolute control over all hiring and firing at the FBI. The FBI was exempt from civil service rules. Hoover had the power to unilaterally demote, transfer without notice, or suspend FBI employees without pay. As soon as Hoover took over the BOI, he fired all of the female agents and banned hiring them in the future. Despite Hoover's legendary career in law enforcement, today he's better known for his many abuses of power while he was in office. For example, Hoover kept dossiers on senators and congressmen who he didn't trust. Anytime an investigation would unearth political dirt or damaging information about a public official, Hoover would send an intermediary to let them know that the FBI was aware of the scandalous issue and that their secret was safe with the FBI. This led officials to think twice before crossing Hoover, who kept everyone's secrets to use as leverage. The constant threat of blackmail from Hoover, combined with his actual role as the head of the FBI, is exactly what made him so powerful. According to a judge who saw documents from Hoover's blackmail activities, The documents were in the thousands, and they contained, quote, scandalous material on public figures to be used for political blackmail. Another example of Hoover's criminality was a dirty tricks program he created called COINTELPRO. The goal of COINTELPRO was initially to disrupt the U.S. Communist Party, a clear violation of the First Amendment, by the way. But eventually, COINTELPRO grew into an operation that spied on anyone who Hoover subjectively believed was spreading communist propaganda. The tactics used in this operation included infiltration, burglaries, setting up illegal wiretaps, planting forged documents, and spreading false rumors about key members of the target organization. Hoover viewed Martin Luther King as a communist sympathizer because of his support for the civil rights movement. As a result, the FBI wrote a letter to King where they encouraged him to kill himself. Today, Dr. King has a federal holiday to celebrate his contributions to the civil rights movement. Yet somehow, the man who led King's illegal government-sponsored persecution still has his name on the outside of the FBI headquarters. So what made J. Edgar Hoover tick? What did he care about? His number one issue was being stridently anti-communist. He prided himself on investigating radicals and subversives. These subjective thought crimes made it easy for Hoover to allege bad motives to any act of any person who he didn't like. It's widely speculated that J. Edgar Hoover was a gay man. He never dated any women, and he lived with his mother until he was 43 years old. His constant companion was the number two man in charge at the FBI, Associate Director Clyde Tolson. Tolson lived just blocks away from Hoover. Each day, they rode to and from work together, and they had lunch and dinner together. They also vacationed together twice every year and would stay in the same bungalow. Hoover and Tolson carried on their relationship for about 40 years until Hoover's death. Today, it's a non-issue when a gay person has a high-ranking government position, but that wasn't the environment during Hoover's time. As a man who was himself gay, it's hard to believe how J. Edgar Hoover treated the gay community. From 1953 until his death in 1972, Hoover personally directed an illegal nationwide surveillance program against gay rights groups. He didn't just fail to stop persecution, he was their persecutor. In his personal life, Hoover liked to listen to soothing music and drink one or two Jack and Cokes every night. He was an avid gardener, he collected antiques, and he loved watching horse races. Hoover lived in Washington his entire life, and he never left the continental United States. But when he did travel, Hoover required a fresh bouquet of flowers to be in his hotel room. Above all else, what J. Edgar Hoover valued the most was holding on to the base of power that he had accumulated for himself as the head of the FBI, with the sole ownership and control of secrets about high-ranking government officials. In 1963, Hoover was 68 years old, and he was facing mandatory retirement due to the 70-year-old age limit of the Civil Service Retirement Act. This meant that unless he was able to get an exemption, Hoover would be forced to retire and lose his grip on power on his 70th birthday, January 1st, 1965, a date when President Kennedy, had he lived, would have still been president. We've heard about Hoover's background and what was important to him. But what about his relationships with the Kennedy administration? Specifically, Robert Kennedy, President Kennedy, and Vice President Johnson. Historically, J. Edgar Hoover always had a direct line to the Oval Office, which meant that he could bypass his superiors in the chain of command. This changed for the first time with the Kennedy administration. Robert Kennedy, the president's brother, was the attorney general, which meant that Hoover was supposed to report to him, not directly to the president. This relationship between Director Hoover and Attorney General Kennedy was rocky, to say the least. Early on, RFK found that he had trouble getting Hoover on the phone. So in January of 1961, he ordered the phone company to install a direct line in Hoover's office with a buzzer. This was done without Hoover's knowledge or approval. In February, Attorney General Kennedy noticed that Hoover's secretary answered the phone when he called the direct line. Kennedy then ordered Hoover's longtime secretary, Helen Gandy, to move the phone back to Hoover's desk. This did not sit well with the director. When the attorney general's aides complained about Hoover not cooperating with the hotline, the attorney general responded that Hoover wouldn't be around much longer, with his mandatory retirement looming on January 1st of 1965. Even though Robert Kennedy remained the attorney general, this hotline from RFK to Hoover was disconnected 1 week after the assassination. Hoover's animosity towards RFK wasn't just because of his insistence about the telephone hotline. Hoover deeply disliked Bobby Kennedy on a personal level. He hated that Kennedy would always have his shirt sleeves rolled up and his tie loosened. He also didn't like that the attorney general would bring his dog and his children to the FBI building. On one Saturday, the attorney general brought his kids with him to Hoover's personal office. While he was there, he was summoned to the White House. The attorney general then asked the director of the FBI to babysit his kids at the FBI office while he went to the White House. Hoover complained about, quote, those brats for weeks afterwards. Perhaps worst of all for Hoover was that RFK would go to the FBI headquarters on weekends and request specific documents, which meant that Hoover had to work on weekends to ensure that RFK didn't receive those documents. It also meant that Hoover had to change his cherished weekend routine. But RFK's insistence on Hoover reporting directly to him instead of to the president didn't stop Hoover from collecting dirt. While Hoover wasn't successful compiling blackmail material against the attorney general, there was plenty of information on President Kennedy. Whenever there was a story in the papers about the president's philandering, Hoover would send copies of the newspaper clippings to the attorney general. Aside from the personal contempt that RFK and Hoover had for one another, they also had fundamental political disagreements about two key issues: the extent to which the Department of Justice should be focused on the mafia, and the nature of the communist threat. Bobby Kennedy came into office on a crusade against organized crime. He told the New Orleans Statesidem on December 28, 1960, that he intended to expedite the deportation proceedings against Carlos Marcello as soon as President Kennedy took office. Hoover, on the other hand, consistently downplayed the significance of mafia activity, saying that the FBI had, quote, much more important functions than arresting bookkeepers and gamblers. When it came to communism, J. Edgar Hoover built a career on investigating and prosecuting Americans who he viewed as subversive or sympathetic to communism. On the other hand, the Kennedy brothers believed that the communist threat was not from people who were already in America, but was instead from foreign countries. Bobby Kennedy would publicly speak out against Hoover's view of communism. For example, on December 3rd, 1961, he told the London Sunday Times, quote, "The American Communist Party couldn't be more feeble and less of a threat. And besides, its membership consists largely of FBI agents." This public exposure of undercover agents and public rebuke of Hoover's worldview did not sit well with the director. The next year, when President Kennedy pardoned Junius Scales for being a member of the Communist Party, Hoover was again reported to be furious. Bobby Kennedy was asked about Hoover in an April 1964 interview, and he said that Hoover was, quote, "dangerous and was rather a psycho." RFK said that the FBI was a very dangerous organization and that Hoover was senile and rather frightening. So it's safe to say that there was no love lost between J. Edgar Hoover and Robert F. Kennedy. But what was Hoover's relationship like with Bobby's brother, the president?
Hey everybody, Matt Crumpton here. When I'm not researching, writing, or recording, one of my favorite ways to relax is with federally legal THC from Mood.com. This stuff doesn't come from a lab. It's pesticide-free and grown on American farms. You can get 20% off your first order using the code JFK. One of my go-tos is the functional gummies from Mood.com. These gummies only take 15 minutes to feel the effects, and you can choose all kinds of different moods, from creativity to pain relief to just plain old relaxation. Everything comes right to your door and is discreetly labeled. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, you also get 20% off of your first order using code JFK. So head on over to Mood.com and find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. Remember, use code JFK for a 20% discount.
Hoover was initially outwardly cooperative with President Kennedy. He was well aware that Kennedy had the power to decide whether or not to grant a waiver from the mandatory retirement that Hoover faced on his 70th birthday. And Kennedy knew that Hoover was aware of his many and ongoing extramarital affairs. But the JFK J. Edgar Hoover honeymoon didn't last long. One of the first things the president did to upset Hoover was on March 17, 1961, when he ordered the post office to stop holding up communist propaganda in the mail from abroad. Kennedy thought that this practice served no useful intelligence function, but Hoover, of course, stuck to his anti-communist views. In a December 8, 1961 speech, Hoover says that America is plagued with Soviet apologists, while implying that President Kennedy was one of them. But it wasn't just tactics on how to deal with communists that Kennedy and Hoover disagreed about. As we just noted, Hoover knew about Kennedy's sexual escapades, and he disapproved of them. He knew that Judith Campbell, the girlfriend of Chicago mob boss Sam Giancana, visited President Kennedy at least 20 times while continuing to see Giancana. During a private lunch between the director and the president on March 22, 1962, Hoover told President Kennedy about five phone calls that he knew of between the president and Judith Campbell. After this meeting with Hoover, JFK called off his dalliance with Judith Campbell and told his aide, Kenny O'Donnell, referring to Hoover, quote, "Get rid of that bastard. He's the biggest bore." On June 22, 1963, President Kennedy met with Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. at the White House. When they were in the Rose Garden, the president told Dr. King that J. Edgar Hoover had him under close surveillance, and he advised King to not discuss any important matters over the phone. Dr. King noted after the meeting that Kennedy was afraid of Hoover. The fact that the president would tell Martin Luther King to watch out for Hoover's surveillance instead of simply ordering Hoover to stop surveilling King demonstrates the power and leverage of J. Edgar Hoover. In contrast to his adversarial relationship with the Kennedy brothers, Hoover was a close friend of Lyndon Johnson. For 19 years, Hoover and Johnson lived directly across the street from one another on 30th Place Northwest in Washington, D.C. Hoover visited Johnson's ranch in Texas in November of 1959 when Hoover was in town as a keynote speaker for a charity fundraiser. Over the course of their relationship, the two men always spoke extremely highly of one another. There are 12 personal letters from Johnson to Hoover between July of 1960 and the day of President Kennedy's assassination. Here's an example of a letter sent by then Vice President Johnson in May of 1963 in response to Hoover asking Johnson to be the keynote speaker at the FBI Academy graduation. "Dear Edgar, I can't let this pleasant opportunity pass by. I'm delighted to be able to say yes to your invitation. Because of my high regard for you and my great respect for the service, I hope you know that I share in the complete and utter devotion that all the men in the FBI have for J. Edgar Hoover. I am so grateful to you and Deke DeLoach for all the many favors you both have done for us." While it's not surprising to see two men who have shared interests speaking kindly about one another, it is rare to hear a public figure lay on the charm this thick when Johnson says that he shares in the complete devotion that the men of the FBI have for Hoover. The reason that the alliance between Hoover and Johnson worked so well was because they were political allies who valued having leverage on their enemies and using it. Each one knew that the other could always be potentially helpful. Hoover relied on LBJ to be a pro-FBI, pro-J. Edgar Hoover voice in the Senate and later in the White House. And Johnson relied on Hoover to help clean up some of the many messes that Johnson made on his ascent to the highest office in the land. There are numerous examples of Hoover going above and beyond to help out Lyndon Johnson, usually in a legally questionable way. Here are just a few. On February 12, 1962, a story was written that linked Johnson to the shady dealings of Billy Sol Estes. This politically damaging story for Johnson was written in the tiny Pecos Independent and Enterprise newspaper. When the CBS National News picked up the local news story, Johnson called Hoover to see if the FBI could go talk to the editor of the newspaper. Hoover agreed, and he sent the number three man at the FBI, Deke DeLoach, to handle the matter of intimidating the local Texas paper. In April of 1962, Congressman Bill Cramer tried to bring impeachment charges against Vice President Johnson based on Johnson's ties to Billy Sol Estes's fraudulent operations. As soon as Johnson found out about the impeachment charges, he had his aide, Walter Jenkins, contact Deke DeLoach to see if the FBI could go speak to Congressman Cramer with the goal of convincing him to drop the impeachment charges. When Hoover was told about Kramer's allegations against Lyndon Johnson, he said, quote, "We have already checked into the story told by Kramer and found it false. Kramer himself is a loud mouth." Hoover recommended that Kramer be interviewed about his allegations immediately. In 1963, Johnson's other big liability, his protege, Bobby Baker, was under investigation by the Senate for various illegal dealings, including allegations of bribery and arranging sexual favors for congressmen. The investigation was heating up in November of 1963 when the Bobby Baker matter was turned over from the Senate to outside counsel. The person who ended up serving as outside counsel was Bill Meehan, a former FBI agent who had just retired from the Bureau and would be relying heavily on the FBI for logistical support. As a practical matter, Hoover had a lot of influence over Meehan's investigation. Ultimately, most of the witnesses who testified in the Bobby Baker investigation claimed Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination, and the matter was dropped in April of 1964. We've talked about J. Edgar Hoover's relationships with John and Robert Kennedy and with Lyndon Johnson, but Hoover also had ties to another group of interest when it comes to the JFK assassination, the Mafia. Much of what we're about to discuss will be covered in more detail when we get to our series on the Mafia. For now, here's a high-level overview of J. Edgar Hoover's relationship with the mob. Hoover knew about the existence of the Mafia since the 1930s and used it as a source of political and criminal information. His earliest mob contact, with whom Hoover became close friends, was Frank Costello, who later went on to become a mob boss from New York. Hoover and Costello would regularly meet in Central Park. On one hand, Hoover appeared to be acting reasonably when it came to enforcing the law against the Mafia. For example, New Orleans FBI agent Regis Kennedy regularly reported on a continuing investigation into Carlos Marcello. The report, which Agent Kennedy would send to Hoover twice each year, always said that Agent Kennedy failed to develop any information showing that Marcello was in violation of any laws enforced by the FBI. On the other hand, Hoover was not supportive of Attorney General Bobby Kennedy's intense effort to attack organized crime at every opportunity. There were numerous actions taken against the Mafia when RFK was the Attorney General. After President Kennedy was killed, Hoover was able to appeal directly to President Johnson instead of having to deal with Bobby as the Attorney General. According to William C. Sullivan, who was at one time the third highest ranking official at the FBI under Hoover, after RFK resigned in September of 1964, quote, "The whole Mafia effort slacked off again." So why would J. Edgar Hoover want to protect the Mafia? After all, he was a man who ostensibly valued justice and putting criminals behind bars. We know from a February 17, 1962 FBI airtell that Angelo Bruno, the Philadelphia mob boss, was aware that Hoover was gay and had a longtime relationship with his deputy, Clyde Tolson. Many historians reasonably speculate that Hoover's knowledge that the Mafia perhaps had evidence of his relationship with Tolson could be the reason why Hoover didn't aggressively pursue the Mafia, and the reason why Hoover pushed back when RFK tried to. In addition to Hoover's relationship with Frank Costello, he had two other friends who were close to New Orleans boss Carlos Marcello: Washington, D.C. lobbyist Irving Davidson, and Texas oil millionaire Clint Murchison. Each year, beginning in 1938, Hoover, usually escorted by Mr. Tolson, would take a vacation to the Del Charro Hotel in La Jolla, California. The hotel was owned by Clint Murchison and fellow Texas oil tycoon Sid Richardson. The bungalow where Hoover and Tolson always stayed was next door to the one owned by Clint Murchison, who was frequently present at the hotel. The director and Mr. Tolson would stay at the hotel for 2 weeks every year during the racing season at the nearby Del Mar racetrack. Hoover never paid a dime for his annual vacations to La Jolla. Hoover would often entertain other guests at his bungalow, including Howard Hughes and organized crime liquor lawyer Arthur Samish. We can say with certainty that Hoover had relationships with key mafia figures through his personal ties to New York boss Frank Costello and the many relationships that Hoover made with mafia and mafia-adjacent people over the years staying at the Hotel Del Charro. Next time on Solving JFK, we continue to examine the actions of the FBI, including the mysterious cancellation of a flash alert about Lee Harvey Oswald by Agent Marvin Giesling. If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Thanks for listening. Visit SolvingJFKPodcast.com for more information.
I'm just happy.